If you're going to be in Chicago this November or December, I have two terrific workshops that you might be interested in. On Saturday, November 20th, I will be offering an in-person long-form workout workshop. The premise is simple. You come, we do quick warm-up, then we just do a series of long forms. You get notes in between just to get those reps in that we haven't gotten during this pandemic. And then on December 31st, Friday, I will be offering my two-person scene tune-up. So if you feel a little rusty, this is a good way to just get the cobwebs out. You haven't gotten coaching, or you feel like you're hitting a rut or something, and you're like, oh, I want to get better at my two-person scenes. This is a great workshop to do that. For more information and to register, just go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy, Jimmy Corain, Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. I'm the host, and our guest today is Jude Leake. She is the writer and producer of a new documentary called Inventing Improv. It is about the mother of improv, the high priestess of improvisation, Viola Spolin. If you don't know Viola Spolin and her work, you may be familiar with her book, Improvisation for the Theater, which is a classic. And in it is over, I think it's 220 games that she developed. And we talked in this interview with Jude about how she went about developing some of those games. Also, the idea that we take for granted in improvisation, where we get a suggestion from the audience, how that came about as well. And her influence on the Second City and the Compass Players. All you have to know is that it all started with Viola. And as I watched this documentary, I just had a lot of gratitude for her work. And I was lucky enough to work with Martin DeMott at Columbia College, who was a disciple of hers. And just how much it's helped me in my performing, but also my teaching, using her games to build ensemble and build connection with my students. So I know it's sometimes not popular to do a lot of Spolin warm-up games, but I've always found it to be beneficial, and there's no other way to create, for me, to create support and trust and ensemble than using those games. So enough about me. Here it is. You're going to love this. The Jude Leake episode, as she talks about her documentary about Viola Spolin. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Jude, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Yay, thank you for having me.
All right, so your documentary is Inventing Improv, and for people that don't know Viola Spolin, she's gotten the title of the mother of improv, the high priestess of improv. Can you tell us why she would have gotten that title?
Well, I think it's because a lot of the work that is being done now is built on the foundation that she created. The games that she created back in, starting probably in the 1920s, at Hull House, and that she built on through the decades of her life, were all about accessing intuition. Her goal was to, her point was to remove barriers, removing any barrier that to true expression or to true experience. And, she was heavily influenced by the progressive education movement and heavily influenced by Neva Boyd and all the work she was doing at Hull House and what was going on politically. And I know this is kind of a deep dive into but it's foundational to her methodology is her experience during the 1920s and what was going on politically and what was going on with the students that she was teaching at the time. It was all about freedom and democracy and what is democracy and how do we access these skills to remove the barriers to true experience. She felt she loved theater too. She wasn't just a social worker. A lot of people want to kind of make her like, oh, she taught children and she was this, or, you know, she was a social worker, but she was that, but she was also a philosopher, an innovator. And she was constantly trying to come up with new tools, new ways to pull out the intuition from the player. And every game that she created, over 200 of them that are used now, and my names might have changed, you know, people have adapted them for performance, like to be performative, because they weren't necessarily performative in the beginning. It was all about accessing that intuition and being able to pull something true onto the stage.
And what I found interesting in your documentary is something that I wasn't conscious of, and I've been teaching this for a while, is that she really felt that through play, you could unblock yourself.
Yeah. She felt that play was the one thing that put the brain, that judging part of your brain, on hold. When you play, your self-consciousness goes away. And if you, and she never called anybody actors. She always called them players. She didn't call herself a teacher because she, in her mind, to be free, you had to be free from hierarchical barriers too. Like, that's why her teaching methodology, she called non-authoritarian and non-judgmental, or not non-verbal, because you learn through doing. So I feel like she gets credit in some ways now, but I feel like she's kind of been left, like the real philosophy of the work, which was pretty esoteric, gets kind of like pushed aside, because it's hard. It's hard to explain why a game where you're playing gibberish and speaking gibberish to somebody is like useful. You know, a lot of people think it's silly. I had people that I would work with and they think these games are stupid, or that they're not, you know, doing anything. And I'm like, what they're doing is it's just so intuitive that you don't even know it's happening. So to play was to be free from the censor, the mental censor, so that you can really access spontaneity.
And the other thing I found fascinating too was a lot of these games, she was making them up in class to solve problems, because she wanted them to experience it through a game versus a lecture.
Exactly. And that's the nonverbal part. People say, well, nonverbal, what do you mean? She didn't talk. And I'm like, no, she talked, but she wasn't telling you what to think or what to feel or how to interpret it. That was like, that's where her teaching, or her experience with Neva Boyd and the progressive education movement really penetrated her brain. She really internalized that on a very deep level and said, whatever I'm teaching them, I have to let them discover it on their own. No lecture, nothing I say to them is going to penetrate like them experiencing that discovery on their own.
So go on.
So when she would create, you know, have a problem, she would sit there and go, okay, what's the barrier here? How can I remove this barrier? Like, for example, Contact is a game that she created because she was working with a lot of kids that didn't speak the same language. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's gibberish. Contact is one where she was working with a lot of kids who were self-conscious about touching each other, self-conscious about their body. And so she would create that game Contact, where every line that you said, you have to make physical contact with another human, with the other player, that made sense. And so the kids started playing the game. And once they have the rules of the game, they became less self-conscious about touching because it was okay. It's a part of the game. And that's the kind of brilliance, is to be able to pinpoint what the barrier is and devise a game. I mean, that's the genius of her, is to acknowledge the barrier and find a way to have the player discover it for themselves. And she has over 200 and something of them. And, you know, they start very simply, and then they work through various levels of difficulty. And so by the end of it, you know, you've got games that help you create dialogue if you're doing something in a scene. They get very complex if you stick with it and you go through the processes.
And then this whole idea of suggestions, which as improvisers we take for granted, it came out of one of her workshops?
Apparently. I mean, this is at Hull House in 1939. She had, and I think she was doing that before, but this was one that gets the most press because there was actually press about it.
Newspapers, 1939. We didn't have TV back then, Jude. It was all print and radio.
And so, you know, Hull House was, you know, doing some amazing work in almost every area. Theater was one of them. And this was just another layer to that. But she did a play called Halsted Street that she directed. And they had over 150 people of different ethnicities, cultural backgrounds, the whole nine yards. And everyone had to contribute. And it was the story was the Halsted trolley car that would go through the neighborhoods and stop at each stop. And every stop would be a different story. And it was told by different immigrant populations. And so many different voices were heard. People, they would get suggestions from the audience, the kids audience, it was people playing, but, and they were all about what they were worried about at the time. So some of them would be like, you know, unemployment and poverty and, bomb shelters, you know, these were the things that were the people were worried about. And so these little scenes would be little moments of their lives and what they were worried about. So that notion of folding in what people were concerned about, the voices of the people, like Second City, you know, now it's all about, we take this so we can get input from the audience to see what's on their mind, you know, what are they worried about? And then they fold that into a wonderful scene. That's exactly what she was doing at Hull House.
She has two sons, and one of her son, Paul Sills, in 1955, goes to start something in the University of Chicago called the Compass Players. And how does he bring his mother in to help the Compass Players?
Well, the Compass Players was David Shepherd's baby in the beginning, as far as like he definitely pulled Paul in, and Paul said, okay, let's go with this. David Shepherd was a big part of that too, and they had worked together in Playwrights Theater Club before that, and they brought Viola in at Playwrights too. Well, actually they started the whole thing with her games at University of Chicago when Paul Sills wanted to start a theater company, but there was no theater company at University of Chicago. He used his mother's games to attract this amazing group of folks who were all interested in the same thing, theater. Whether it's Mike Nichols or Elaine May or Ed Asner, they all showed up and was in Pivens, you know, they were there.
Joyce and Vern Piven.
Yes. And so they were all kind of playing her games early on. So they had an idea. David Shepherd wanted to have this theater of the people, you know, and Paul Sills was like, yes. So they brought Viola in again to play games. They had to create their own dialogue. They're going to have to create their own scenarios. So she had, and she probably created games for that purpose on the spot. I'm not really sure which games were created when, so I can't, you know, speak with any certainty on that, but I'm sure that when they said, this is what we want to do, she's like, all right, let's make a game of it. And, and help the players get comfortable on stage, working without a script, get comfortable making room for each other, following each other, learning how to read each other. A lot of what she did during that time was just the ensemble work of being able to read the other player, and to make room for them and not to deny their experience. You know, she was very, that was one of the things too. It's like, if they bring it in, integrate it, you know? So, she was essential at getting the players to a space where they were comfortable and free on stage to be able to at the time, it was not about comedy at all. Now she loved comedy when it came out of a moment of spontaneity. You know, because that to them, and Paul Sills was the same way. Don't you try to be funny. Don't you even try. You know, the funny was fine. And these people were brilliant. So the funny was going to come, but it was about truth. It was about finding a moment and being truthful about it. And, you know, Paul Sills has he's very well known for his adherence to truth over the funny joke, you know. But Viola was completely necessary to build this first group of players that were really comfortable or got to a place where they were comfortable enough being up there flying solo without anything.
And that becomes the beginning, really, of the attention to improv, because the Compass is the first national recognized improv theater in the country.
Right.
And then 4 years later, Paul Sills with Howard Alk and Bernie Solins open a theater called The Second City. And how does that change the profile of Viola Spolin in her work?
Well, Viola said that, you know, Paul took it to the world, her work. Her work was in the beginning, it wasn't performative necessarily. It was all to build ensemble and to build these muscle memory in these players of how to trust their intuition and to bring out their experience in a way that was truthful. And so when, you know, what they learned with Compass, which I think is important too, is that it was really hard to do it. They did a show like every week, a new show every week. And it was really hard to keep that pace up. So, you know, what they started to do was setting pieces that worked. So that built the foundation for kind of the Second City model. So they weren't going to be improvising per se, except for in rehearsal and getting these scenes set for the show.
This was at Second City. They were going to.
Right. That's what they're just learning. I think Compass really taught them what people wanted. You know, you always come into a new venture with an idea of what you want. And then you get feedback from the audience telling you what they want. And I think Compass was very popular. It was extremely, it took off like crazy. But it just kind of fizzled because what David Shepherd wanted was hard to, he wanted kind of a more pure working man's theater. And he was very disenchanted with what it was kind of turning into. It was all about the funny. And so he kind of took off and kind of did his thing. And so it's like, well, we know what works. We kind of see, we learned what works and what people want. So let's try that. So again, Viola comes in to ready the cast again and she always was pretty instrumental at it. Her work was in training new people because people were getting scooped up right away because it took off and people loved it and it got a lot of national press and they had to have her come in and she was constantly training new players at the same time that she was writing her book that was going to be released soon after Second City opened in 1959. I think her book came out in 63, I want to say. I might be wrong, yes. But I think it was 63. And that, you know, she was there for years kind of helping to build the foundation and to kind of set the model of how to train people that Joe Forsberg kind of became her, who took over for her and kind of like, you know, after she went back to California to get back to her work there. So I really feel like when people came in, they were learning the foundational Spolin games to train the next generation.
So, Spolin created this for actors when she started. And how do you think she would feel about, you know, now people go into improv, they're not actors. How do you think she would feel about it today?
I would never venture to guess what that woman would think because she was a special breed of folk. The reason it took her so long to write her book, one of the reasons, is because she wanted to free everyone from entrapment of language. Like in all the editions, you know, she would relook at something and say this word has lost meaning because it's overused or, you know, whatever. And she would try to to redirect or shake up, you know, whatever mental image you have of what she was trying to get across. I think she knew the power of this, of the work and how it was going to be used. Now hers is what we would call more a pure improvisational approach. And I think once it became, I don't even remember who said it, but once you become, there was a quote that I heard during the making of this, it really stuck with me. Once you become a producer over a creator, it kind of changes how you approach it. Meaning once you commoditize it, you got to make money, right? And once you get, it's that age old conflict between commerce and art. To make something sustainable, a model sustainable that's going to continue, you have to listen to the audience and you've got to go where they want to go. Her work went all over the place. So I think she'd be ecstatic about where the work went in terms of how it's being used therapeutically, educationally, and in all the other theaters. Steppenwolf, you know, Sheldon Patinkin took her book and, you know, he's touched pretty much every theater in Chicago as far as like the founding members. And he took her work to Steppenwolf. They have it. They worked, you know, it has many lives, you know, and I think she'd be ecstatic about that.
And, you know, as I was watching your documentary, I was like, why do you think she didn't get enough credit or get more credit?
Well, I have to watch the landmines here. There's some landmines out there. There's lots of, you know, I think the people in it that are in it for the love of it, especially the ones that came in early, like in the early 70s. And maybe the late 60s, anywhere between, I think they get it and they understand her contribution. I was talking to Jeff Michalski and he was talking about.
Now, who's he?
Jeff. He's yeah. Jane.
Oh,
Norris.
Jeff Michalski. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't notice
that. He talked about the masculinization of improv, which mm-hmm. I thought was a really interesting concept that I hadn't thought about before, but I would say that it's become more competitive. And I think that she created something that was meant to be purely democratic. And it takes time and that takes cultivation and nurturing. and I think when that's the whole thing with art and commerce, once again, it's like once that happens and you commoditize it and it becomes really competitive, it loses its kind of its focus. And it's still funny and it still works and you know, but it's different. I would say to improv today is it's more competitive based. And that was not how she envisioned it.
And how much in the mix of what you talked about, the masculinity of improv, is this woman, Viola, fighting? She doesn't want to be a guru. She doesn't, you know, how much is that in that, you know, she's more about the art. She's more about, you don't need my approval. I'm exactly. the teacher is secondary. That might have affected it as well.
I think that's true. I think that's a really good point. And I think that, you know, I don't want to jump off on some, you know, woman thing because she was a radical thinker. And she wanted you to make the discovery yourself. And because so many people did make the discovery themselves, they thought they discovered it, you know? And so I think that's a part of it as well. You know, Del Close is a guru. He's amazing. And everybody knows his story. And he took her work and he made, you know, he built on that and did his thing. But he also self-promoted too, or promoted his work. Which you should. And I think you're right. I think that she was definitely someone who wanted to have you make those discoveries yourself so that you could own it. But she was also, she stood her ground. There was a time when, you know, you saw the cards, her Spolin game file. There was a point when I think that, I don't remember who it was that did it, but somebody had started to do that. And she stopped that. And she said, that's my work, you know?
Well, she took legal action to prevent it. And then she released it, her own version, you know?
And then she did it her own. So I think a lot of it was just, you know, a lot of it was unfolding, and it was something that was kind of always in process. So, you know, for her to take a minute, and she was a very busy woman, to take a minute and just do what she needed to protect herself. I think there was a trial and error. Like she would, oh, I need to do that. I need to make sure that the stuff is protected. And there was a story too of David Shepherd had even wanted, had was going to write a book. And she reached out to him and said, you know, this work comes from someplace, you know? And he honored that, and he didn't betray that trust. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think it came from that place of, I want people to have ownership of their discoveries, and her approval disapproval syndrome thing that you kind of mentioned a little bit, which I think is fascinating. I think she would be so entirely depressed to see like social media. She was worried about television, you know, at the time, taking children's, you know, making it difficult for them to access their imagination and their true potential. She thought television was bad. I can't imagine what she would think about social media and the likes and the da 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 and the disapproval. You can't create in that space. And we kind of see that now. I mean, I think it's made creation really hard because everybody's really working for that approval and that love. And if they don't get it, you know, the virtual mob can come after you too. And that's a whole other thing. I mean, how do you create in that environment? I don't know. I think she would be really like, whoa, we need to get back to ensemble work. We need to get back to human connection again, because we're getting off on a bad road.
So I know, as someone who's, I've taught for many years now, and the one thing that I've seen, and I use her games, and she's been a huge inspiration to me. But I've noticed that the whole warm-up games that we do when we teach are Spolin-based, and there seems to be a trend of not doing those as much. And to me, that's the glue. That's where ensemble lies. Did you see any of that in your research, that this trend is happening?
A trend about moving away from the games?
Yes, moving away from the games. Let's in improv, it's like, let's go to the scenes, or let's do the form. And really, to me, I can't build ensemble unless I use the games, or I'm not doing it. The games are doing it.
You know what? I think you're absolutely right. And I heard so many people say we need it more than ever, because with it becoming more and more competitive too, there tends to be that everybody's coming in and wanting to make their mark, right? They want to stand out, you know, and they come into scenes thinking, writing in their head what they want to project of their talent. To answer your question, yes, I have seen that there's been a movement away from those games, partly because they're seen as simplistic, or, you know, that, I don't know, and this might be part of the masculinization thing that Jeff mentioned and I talked to you about a little, this kind of, because it's to be in that space where you're doing the warm-up games, you're really giving space to the other player, and you're really in that, that dance between each other. And that can be kind of uncomfortable for people. And I really feel like it is the thing. It is the glue. When you're forced to, like Mirror, for example, and people, I love Mirror. I watched, you know, a couple of different, I did it when I was young and I didn't understand, well, because I was with a teacher who didn't teach very well. But what happens when you really, really give over to that, be the exact mirror? I mean, you really tune in a way that, if you let yourself, becomes kind of like Bob Balaban in the documentary. It's not psychic, but it's psyche. You really start to vibe off each other. You can kind of, you give each other signals that unless you do that work, you're on stage, you're not going to pick up on. So I think it's essential to do that work, to build a team. And even if it's just for a weekend, it's amazing how intimate those games are. If you allow yourself to kind of remove the armor, Viola called it our armor. If you remove that armor, you really can kind of melt into each other a little bit. And that builds a space for creativity, but it also builds a space for connection. And that's what, you know, I think we're losing today is more of that connection, the human connection.
So we've got to wrap this up, but before we go, okay. And I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No worries. So,
we like to have one tip to give to somebody who's in improv today. And based on all your research, and my God, the work you put into this documentary, it's really beautiful. And what is one piece of advice maybe you got from Viola or Aretha Sills or Paul Sands or LNR, Aldo, somebody there
all
that you
them.
Would like to share?
Well, Aretha taught me so much and, you know, learning Viola through her, a lot of it. I would say, and to your listeners, I would say, do the work. Don't think that it's simplistic, because if you go and, I mean, just have a party. I mean, I had a party with these games and it's amazing the connection that you get with people when you do it. Don't be afraid to slow down and just really do the work. That would be my suggestion.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
And there you have it, another great episode of Improv Nerd. I want to thank our guest, Jude Leek. And please check out the documentary, Inventing Improv, a Chicago Story Special. To see it on Friday, October 22nd, there's two ways to check it out. You can go to the website. It will be online Friday, October 22nd at wttw.com/improv. That's wttw.com/improv. If you're in Chicago, you can see it on WTTW on October 22nd. That's a Friday at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. I want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Check us out on all our social media platforms like Facebook. Go to the Improv Nerd fan page and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. And then follow us on Twitter, which is improv_nerd. And thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.